the pain you experience in the extremes of sustained exercise is fundamentally different, from your brain's perspective, from the pain you experience while dunking your hand in ice water. All pleasure is alike, as Leo Tolstoy might have put it, but each pain hurts in its own unique way. The doors to the Velodrome Suisse in Gränschen, a small town midway between Zurich and Geneva, opened at 5:30 p.m. on September 18, 2014. The time had been precisely calculated to allow the collective presence of 1,600 fans to warm and humidify the air in the building to just the right degree before the start of Voigt's record attempt, 90 minutes later. Warm air is less dense and thus offers an aerodynamic advantage, but too much warmth risks overheating the cyclist. These were the kinds of details that Voigt's team had fretted endlessly over, and the result of all this careful preparation was that he knew he was capable of the record, but he also knew how slender his margin of error was. You can have a puncture, you can start out too fast, you can just have a bad day. Hey, you can even have two punctures. These were the thoughts caroming around in Voigt's mind as, with the help of two assistants, he wriggled into a specially designed sausage-tight skin suit in the locker room. With a packed stadium, more than 4 million cycling fans around the world watching him on television, and others tuning in to the live internet stream, it's easy to understand why he felt acutely anxious in these final minutes. And yet, for a man about to test the limits of his own pain tolerance for a full hour, this was a crucial advantage. Like a wounded soldier on a battlefield, or a kudu cornered by a hungry lion, athletes in the heat of competition exhibit a phenomenon called stress-induced analgesia, which enables them to ignore otherwise debilitating levels of pain. Finally, the starting gun fired, and to the techno-punk beat of Republica's mid-1990s hit, Ready to Go, Voigt stood up in his saddle and began pedaling. Some of the most epic tales and Bunyan-esque feats in sports involve athletes who defied pain to score the winning point or outlast their opponent. Hockey player Bobby Bonds' overtime winner for the Toronto Maple Leafs in the 1964 Stanley Cup Finals, skating on an ankle he had fractured earlier in the game. Willis Reed taking on Wilt Chamberlain in the 1970 NBA Finals with a torn thigh muscle. Kerry Strug's gold medal clinching vault on a sprained ankle at the 1996 Olympics. In fact, playing through a broken limb isn't even that rare. Even when the stakes are lower, Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Donovan McNabb had the best passing game of his career on a broken ankle in 2002. Boston Bruins center Gregory Campbell played out a shorthanded shift after a slap shot broke his fibula during the 2013 playoffs. Denver Broncos safety David Bruton Jr. played another 95 snaps on a broken fibula after a first-quarter collision in 2015. And it's not just bruisers in full-contact sports who do it. At the Vancouver Olympics in 2010, Slovenian cross-country skier Petra Majdic slipped during her warm-up and fell 10 feet into a rock-strewn creek. Not realizing that she had broken 5 ribs, she skied through excruciating pain in her qualifying round, quarterfinals, semifinals, during which one of the cracked ribs pierced a lung, causing it to collapse, and finals, where she earned a stupendously improbable bronze medal. Then, finally, she went to the hospital. There's no doubt these athletes are tough, but their heroics are also, to some extent, enabled by the circumstances. The way most of us think of pain was most famously articulated by French philosopher René Descartes in his 1664 Treatise of Man. You whack your thumb with a hammer, and this sends a message that, in Descartes' imagery, rings a bell in your brain. In this view, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the damage or injury you've suffered and the pain you feel. The problem with this view is that the same injury can provoke dramatically different reactions in different people, or even in the same person at different times. At the opposite extreme, amputees with phantom limb syndrome experience real pain that has no physical source. As a result, starting with observations of wounded soldiers during the U.S. Civil War, doctors and pain researchers have concluded that pain is fundamentally a subjective, situation-dependent phenomenon. For example, stress, fear, and anxiety activate an impressive array of brain chemicals, including endorphins, the body's store-brand opioid drugs, and endocannabinoids, the body's cannabis, to dull or completely block pain that would overwhelm you in other circumstances. In evolutionary terms, pain may serve a valuable function by telling you to stop and allow an injury to heal. But if you're a deer being chased by a wolf and you trip and break a leg, says Mogul, the McGill pain researcher, you need to forget about that pain until later. Breaking your leg and chasing a new marathon best, it should be said, differ greatly in the nature and degree of pain incurred. The palette of pain is infinitely variable, and athletes sample widely. Even without broken ribs, a sprint skier like Majdic, whose event lasts less than 4 minutes, will encounter a flood of metabolites that sear her muscles from within. An ultra runner might run for hours at a seemingly easy pace, but eventually be hobbled by cumulative micro tears in her muscles that send high voltage bursts of pain through her calves and quads with every step. And somewhere between these two extremes, the worst of both worlds, according to those who have tried it, lies the hour. Part of the hour's horror lies in its setting. No scenery, no competitors, no pace changes, almost no external feedback of any sort. The lack of distraction robs you of a powerful way of altering how the brain perceives pain, the psychological version of rubbing a bruise to interfere with pain signals in the muscle. But the duration of the race also happens to lie on a physiological knife edge. There are many ways of delineating the boundary between short and uncomfortable high-intensity exercise and longer, more pleasant efforts. One of the most familiar is lactate threshold, the point at which you're working hard enough that levels of lactate in your blood start creeping inexorably upward. A more recently developed concept is critical power, which is the point beyond which your muscles can no longer stay in the sustainable steady-state equilibrium fetishized by Harvard Fatigue Laboratory researchers. 60 minutes of all-out exercise for a well-trained athlete sits in the excruciating gap between these two markers, explains Mark Burnley, a physiologist in the University of Kent's Endurance Research Group. Riders in the hour have to exercise above lactate threshold, but very slightly below the critical power. In other words, ride with the highest metabolic rate that is also steady state. Done right then, the hour is literally the longest bout of painful, high-intensity exercise you can endure. For Voigt's final professional ride, the king of pain attacking the sport's ultimate test of mental mettle, the most painful challenge turned out to be saddle sores from the awkward and unfamiliar riding position. He had started quickly, covering the 250-meter laps in just over 17 seconds, and soon built a comfortable margin ahead of his pre-ride goal of averaging 17.9 seconds per lap. The first 10 minutes felt easy. After 20 minutes, as the fatigue set in, he throttled back slightly, searching for that knife edge of sustainability. By the halfway point, his tailbones were so raw that he began to stand up out of the saddle every 10 laps to relieve the pressure, a flagrant aerodynamic faux pas for a rider whose sponsors had provided a special skin suit, wind-defying gloves, and even drag-minimizing socks. In this case, Voigt was far enough ahead of the record that his saddle sores didn't scuttle the effort. By the time he passed 200 laps, the triumphant synth of Europe's The Final Countdown spurring on his last push, he had the record well enough in hand that he could finally let his thoughts wander briefly. There was pride in his achievement, joy that it had all gone according to plan, relief that it was almost over, all mixed with sadness that his days of stardom were ending. Finally, the gun sounded to signal the hour's end, and the pain he'd been pushing to the margins of his consciousness came crashing down. Everything was aching. My neck ached from holding my head low in that aerodynamic position. My elbows hurt from holding my upper body in that position. My lungs hurt after burning and screaming for oxygen for so long. My heart hurt from the constant pounding. My back was on fire. And then there was my butt. I was really and truly in a world of pain. The scoreboard read 51,110 meters, eclipsing the previous record by 1,410 meters, nearly a mile. Voigt's record lasted all of 6 weeks, before falling to an unheralded Austrian named Matthias Brandl, at 24 years old, nearly two decades younger than Voigt. The record fell three more times in 2015, the last time to a true heavyweight, former Tour de France winner and five-time Olympic champion Bradley Wiggins, who pushed the record out to 54,526 meters. Voigt's timing, thanks to the confluence of the UCI rule change and his impending retirement, was certainly lucky. But his name is, and will always remain, on one of the most exclusive lists in cycling. Did Voigt really suffer more than the rest of us? While there are still plenty of gaps in the research, it does appear that top athletes really push themselves to a darker place and stay there longer than most people are willing to tolerate. But the more interesting comparison isn't between Voigt and Joe Sixpack. It's between Voigt and Wiggins and the rest of the elite peloton. Studies of truly elite athletes are few and far between, and it's nearly impossible to collect heat-of-the-battle data when the athletes are pushing hardest. Remember Tim Noakes' picture of the Olympic marathon champion and the man he had just outsprinted by 3 seconds? Did the silver medalist really let immortality slip from his grasp because it hurt too much? The experiments that Alexis Mauger and Samuel Marcora have done trying to untangle the difference between pain and effort make me think that pain, in most contexts, is a warning light on the dashboard. It instructs you, sometimes very insistently, to slow down. And in most contexts, you heed that warning without even realizing you're doing it. But it's not an absolute limit. For that, we have to look elsewhere. Chapter 6. Muscle. On a warm Tucson evening in July 2006, Tom Boyle and his wife, Elizabeth, were waiting to merge from a shopping mall parking lot onto South Kolb Road, a fast-moving six-lane thoroughfare. The car in front of their pickup truck, a Camaro, squealed its tires to seize a gap in the passing traffic, and suddenly there was a shower of sparks. "Oh, my God," Elizabeth blurted. "Do you see that?" The car had plowed into a cyclist, riding the wrong way along South Kolb, and was now dragging both rider and bike along the road underneath it. Boyle leapt out of his pickup truck and started running as the Camaro, 20 or 30 feet away, finally slithered to a halt. You know how this story goes. Boyle found the cyclist, 18-year-old Kyle Holtrust, pinned under the front wheels of the car. "As soon as I get to the car, the boy's just screaming his head off, and I could tell he was in a lot of pain," Boyle later recalled. So he lifted the car up. "Mister, mister, higher, higher," Holtrust screamed. When it was high enough, Boyle yelled to the Camaro's driver, who snapped out of a daze and pulled Holtrust out. Then he put the car down and held Holtrust in his arms until emergency personnel arrived. The boy survived, and Boyle's feet entered the crowded but hard-to-verify annals of hysterical strength. When your legs fail you, it's natural to blame your legs. Same is true whether you're lifting a piano, pedaling a bike up the Alpe de Huisse, or clinging by your fingertips to a narrow fissure in an overhanging rock face. There are times when it feels like your muscles are simply and unambiguously maxed out. In prolonged tests of endurance, this feeling is muddied by all the other sensations flooding your synapses. Pounding heart, rasping lungs, flagging willpower, and so on. In short, all-out efforts, on the other hand, we get a much cleaner picture. Either you can lift the car, or you can't. That's why feats like Boyle's are so confounding. In the long-running debate about whether we're able to use every ounce of strength our muscles possess, they seem to demolish everything we think we know. Muscles do have limits, of course. As far back as the 19th century, physiologists were wiring up frogs' legs and making them dance with electric shocks until the muscles became totally unresponsive. And in those heady days before universities had research ethics boards, it was a short step to trying similar experiments on humans. Researchers like Angelo Mosso, the Italian physiologist who pioneered the study of mental fatigue, as described in Chapter 4, tried to compare the force his subjects could produce voluntarily with the force their muscles could produce when stimulated electrically. If the involuntary contractions were stronger than the voluntary ones, the thinking went, it would demonstrate that we have some sort of protective mechanism, a central governor for strength, in effect, to make sure we don't tear our tendons and yank our muscles off the bone. But at that point, measurement techniques weren't advanced enough to settle the question one way or the other. There were, however, other hints of muscular capacity held in reserve. In 1939, for example, German researchers published the results of their experiments with a newly developed drug called Pervitin, showing that endurance in a cycling test could be tripled with no apparent changes in metabolism or circulation. Their conclusion was that the end point of any performance is never an absolute fixed point, but rather is when the sum of all negative factors, such as fatigue and muscle pain, are felt more strongly than the positive factors of motivation and willpower. The drug was an early version of crystal methamphetamine, and German military officials took a keen interest in the results. They piloted Pervitin later that year on military drivers deployed in the invasion of Poland, which triggered World War II. Convinced of its usefulness, the Nazis distributed it to all branches of the military. Between April and July 1940 alone, more than 35 million tablets of Panzerschokolade, tank chocolate, fueled the blitzkrieg across Europe, spurring lasting rumors of a Nazi superpill that gave soldiers extraordinary powers. The dark after-effects of crystal meth became clearer over time, and German officials restricted its use in 1941, though it remained widely used until the end of the war, and stayed part of the East German Army's war chest until 1988. Tom Boyle wasn't on crystal meth when he lifted the car, but he certainly had adrenaline coursing through his veins. In a series of experiments in the late 1950s, researchers Michio Ikai, a former student of A.V. Hill, and Arthur Steinhaus tested some of the ways that extreme situations like near-death experiences might enhance strength. They instructed their subjects to flex their forearms as hard as possible once per minute each time the second hand of an electric timer swept past 1 o'clock for 30 minutes. Injections of adrenaline, they reported in the Journal of Applied Physiology, produced a statistically insignificant increase of 6.5% in strength. Amphetamine tablets boosted strength more robustly by 13.5%. Better yet, having one of the researchers standing directly behind the unwarned subject fire a .22-caliber starter's gun a few seconds before a scheduled contraction boosted the strength of that contraction by an average of 7.4%. These results are often trotted out as evidence that feats of superhuman strength are possible under the right circumstances. What's seldom mentioned is that Ikai and Steinhaus also claim to see average strength increases of 26.5% after hypnosis, with large increases persisting even after the hypnotic state was broken. The power of these trances was so great that when the hypnotist touched one skeptical subject with a fountain pen while telling him that it was a red-hot poker, the blister that appeared within the hour took a week to heal and served to convince the subject of the reality of hypnosis. The increases in strength, the researchers argued, occurred because hypnosis, or drugs, or fright, allowed the subjects to overcome their deep-seated inhibitions. For example, one athletically inclined yet genuinely feminine subject had as a child been constantly warned by her mother not to overdo exertion and was mocked and called Miss Football in high school for being too athletic. Hypnosis, according to Ikai and Steinhaus, allowed her to leave the resulting inhibitions behind and increase her strength by 50%. It's worth noting that more than a half century later, these findings haven't been replicated under controlled conditions. There's also a key difference between lifting a car once and producing maximal contractions over and over again. In 2014, a team led by Israel Halpern at Memorial University of Newfoundland tried a similar experiment, with subjects doing 5-second maximal biceps curls against an immovable resistance every 15 seconds. One group was told they'd be doing 6 contractions, another was told they'd be doing 12, and a third group was simply told to keep going until instructed to stop. But once the experiment started, all 3 groups had to do 12. In theory, the instructions shouldn't have made any difference, because the subjects were explicitly and repeatedly told not to pace themselves. Each contraction was supposed to be as hard as possible, with nothing held in reserve. In practice, though, expectations mattered. Within a few reps, those who thought they were only doing 6 were producing slightly more force than the 12-rep control group. And those with no information about how long they would be expected to continue were producing less force than the other groups. Not surprisingly, the average force declined with each succeeding rep until the last one and the 6th one in the deceived group, when they were able to summon a finishing kick to exert more force. The pattern overall looked a lot like the U-shaped pattern observed in distance running world records. And, like my own hardwired fast finish pacing in 5,000-meter races, even in short, supposedly all-out maximal contractions, when we're explicitly told to hold nothing in reserve, we pace ourselves. A finding that helps explain why Ikai and Steinhaus were seemingly able to tap into hidden reserves of strength, but doesn't explain how a human can lift a car. At the 1983 World's Strongest Man competition in Christchurch, New Zealand, a fresh-faced Canadian powerlifter named Tom McGee, later known as Mega Man during a brief World Wrestling Federation career, deadlifted 1,180 pounds of local cheddar cheese. Enough, the television commentator deadpanned, to fill an awful lot of mousetraps. That feat, with two towering stacks of cheese blocks connected by a flexible bar that started 18 inches off the ground, remains the heaviest verified deadlift on record. The records using standard bars and plates are a bit lighter. In contrast, a typical Camaro, even stripped down for drag racing, weighs at least 3,000 pounds. Even if we assume that life-or-death situations can summon extra strength, that still seems like an awfully large gap. One commonly cited estimate of the difference between voluntary and truly maximal strength comes from Vladimir Zatsiorsky, a biomechanics expert who spent three decades at the Central Institute of Physical Culture in Moscow, the hub of scientific research for the Soviet sports system, before moving to Penn State in the early 1990s. In his 1995 treatise, Science and Practice of Strength Training, a dense training Bible that still has a cult following, Zatsiorsky reported that most of us can summon about 65% of our theoretical maximum strength. Elite weightlifters can do better, hefting more than 80% of their maximum in workouts, and with the psychological boost of a big competition, they can lift, according to one of Zatsiorsky's studies, an additional 12.5% compared to their training best. Plug these numbers in, and you find that McGee, with the fear of God buzzing in his circuits, might have been able to hoist another 100 or 200 pounds of cheese, but still, less than half a Camaro. So, how did Zatsiorsky determine the true maximum strength of his weightlifters? That is either lost in the mists of time or buried in obscure mid-20th century Soviet sports journals. Some experts are highly skeptical. Guillaume Millet, a French researcher who heads the University of Calgary's Neuromuscular Fatigue Lab, says Zatsiorsky's numbers are absolutely crazy. When I contacted Zatsiorsky in 2016, he was 83 years old, long retired from Penn State, but still very active as a researcher. He was listed as co-author of no less than 7 academic journal articles dealing with the subtleties of motor control that were published between January and September of that year. But he couldn't fill in any details about his much-quoted maximum strength numbers. Unfortunately, he told me in an email, I do not remember who mentioned these facts first. That doesn't automatically mean they're wrong. After all, one of the reasons they crop up in so many scientific explanations of superhuman strength is that they sound plausible. But plausibility isn't the same as proof. While no one has managed to definitively confirm or refute Zatsiorsky's findings, it's not for lack of trying. The idea that we all harbor a hidden reserve of muscular strength gained currency in the early 1900s as experiments with electricity proliferated. As a pair of Danish researchers wrote in 1923, everyone who has experience of having his muscles stimulated by electrical stimuli knows that it is possible in this way to obtain contractions of a force which is quite impossible to reproduce voluntarily. But actually, measuring this reserve was challenging, because most human movements use several different muscle groups triggered by different nerve pathways, unlike the crude single muscle twitch produced by an electric shock. It wasn't until 1954 that a cheerfully eccentric British physiologist named Patrick Merton devised a solution. He would clamp a subject's forearm, usually his own, leaving the other hand free to take measurements, so that only the thumb could move, and only in one specific direction activated by the adductor pollicis muscle. When he compared the thumb's maximal voluntary force with the force produced by an escalating series of sustained electric shocks to the associated nerve, repeated up to 50 times per second, he came to two surprising conclusions. First, the force produced by the shocks felt far greater. They also hurt. The considerable pain caused is minimized if the skin under the stimulating electrode is not broken, he noted. And second, the actual force was essentially the same. The supposed reserve of muscular strength, in other words, was an illusion. A result, Merton concluded, that flew in the face of the then widespread belief that lunatics, persons suffering from tetanus or convulsions or under hypnosis, and those drowning are exceptionally powerful. Merton strengthened his case with a novel twist. While his subjects voluntarily contracted their thumb muscles, he superimposed a brief electrical twitch. If the voluntary contraction was relatively weak, the force would jump significantly when the twitch was added. But for stronger voluntary contractions, the size of the twitch got progressively smaller. And for maximal contractions, the brief electric shock didn't add any force at all, suggesting once again that no extra muscle remained unused. In the years since then, similar experiments have been repeated many times under many different conditions. In addition to triggering muscle contractions with electric shocks, researchers now use pulses of magnetic stimulation directly to the brain's motor cortex to produce short muscle contractions elsewhere in the body. Another technique pioneered using more painful electric shocks to his own skull by the intrepid Merton. In order to tease out where and how fatigue takes place. Overall, according to Roger Anoka, who directs the University of Colorado Boulder's Neurophysiology of Movement Lab, the modern consensus from these studies echoes Merton's finding. Most healthy people can achieve voluntary action scores of close to 100%. In Mark Burnley's lab at the University of Kent, typical scores for all-out quadriceps contractions are 92 to 97%, and anything less than 90% suggests something has gone wrong with the test. Under normal conditions, in other words, we're utilizing pretty much all the strength our muscles have to offer. There are, however, two possible loopholes, Anoka notes. One is that you can't sustain 100% activation indefinitely. So, the idea of a hidden muscle reserve makes more sense for cyclists and rowers and runners than for piano movers. The other is the difference between twitching your thumb and, say, deadlifting a car. A movement that requires a deceptively intricate synchronized pattern of activation involving at least 13 different muscle groups. It's possible that these complex real-world actions make it harder to reach full voluntary activation in all the relevant muscle groups, meaning there might be some reserve accessible in stressful situations. This prospect hasn't been tested, Anoka says, and it's not clear that such a test is even possible with current technology, which is why Zatsiorsky's claims are so intriguing. With this loophole in mind, Tom Boyle's Camaro hoisting exploits remain at least plausible, especially when you factor in some basic but often neglected physics. Boyle, after all, didn't lift the car right off the ground. At most, he raised the front axle, which would involve lifting less than half the weight of the car, thanks to the leverage advantage provided by lifting from the very front. But even that may be an overestimate thanks to the car's suspension system. Think about what happens when you change a spare tire. The jack lifts only one wheel off the ground, elevating, at a very rough estimate, a quarter of the car's weight, which for a Camaro is in the range of 750 pounds. And Boyle may not have needed to actually get the front wheel or wheels airborne to free the cyclist. He just had to get enough weight off the victim to allow the driver of the car to pull the cyclist out from underneath. Without seeing the exact details of the rescue, it's impossible to know how much force the feat required. But 800 pounds could conceivably have been enough. And Boyle is, as journalist Jeff Wise described him, no panty waist. He's 6'4", weighs 280 pounds, and has deadlifted 700 pounds in the gym. Add in Zatsiorsky's 20% reserve for experienced weightlifters, and you get a potential true strength of 840 pounds. Of the many stories of superhuman strength out there, this one comes closest to passing the sniff test. Whatever happened that night, it seems clear the horror of the situation allowed Boyle to transcend his normal limits. It wasn't until he got home that night that he noticed he had clenched his jaw so tightly during the lift that he had broken 8 teeth. By the time Stéphane Coulot reached the alpine town of Donas, he'd been running for almost 34 hours. He had traversed 95 miles of vertiginous trails across the peaks and passes, encircling the Vallée d'Aosta, the valley on the Italian side of the point where the Italian, French, and Swiss borders collide, alternately shivering and sweating as he passed in and out of cold rains and valley microclimates, and the sun rose, set, and rose again. The route had taken him up and down more than 35,000 feet. An Everest and a quarter. And he wasn't even halfway done. Coulaud, an experienced mountain runner who in 2009 had set a record with a 10-day traverse of the Pyrenees, was sitting in 7th place in one of the most grueling ultra-trail races in the world, the Tour des Géants. By the admittedly warped standards of the ultra-endurance world, the race's 205-mile distance is relatively tame. You want crazy? Try a double-decker Ironman triathlon, which starts with a 47-mile swim followed by a 2,200-mile bike ride and a 524-mile run, and takes about 20 days to finish, if you're the winner. But the race's punishing topography, with ankle-twisting trails and nearly 80,000 feet of ascent and descent as it skirts 4 of the tallest mountains in the Alps, Mont Blanc, Gran Paradiso, Monte Rosa, and the Matterhorn, is what sets it apart. With no scheduled rest breaks, the top runners typically complete the course in around 80 hours, pausing for at most a few hours of sleep. If there is a race that will squeeze every last twitch from your aching quads, this is the one. In the aid station at Donas, Coulot paused to refuel and take a short break. But first, a pair of researchers rushed him through a 30-minute sequence of tests. His body composition was measured with a Z-matrix bioimpedance system. A nurse drew blood and measured the circumference of his thighs and calves to check for inflammation. He whizzed through a computerized cognitive test. He completed a series of maximal leg contractions with and without electrical stimulation to assess the decline in muscle strength and voluntary activation. And he balanced, first with eyes opened and with eyes closed, on a force-measuring plate until, as his body struggled to adjust its blood pressure to the luxury of rest, he passed out. He had completed the same tests before the race started and would complete them again at the finish, if he made it. One of the masterminds behind this cruel ordeal was Guillaume Millet, who, in addition to his research role, was a former national team cross-country skier and accomplished ultra-trail runner. He had finished third in the 2010 Tour des Géants. For more than a decade, Millet had been studying muscle fatigue at the opposite end of the spectrum from Merton's short maximal spasms, trying to quantify and explain the loss of force in progressively longer and more extreme challenges. A ski marathon, a 5-hour treadmill run, a 24-hour treadmill run, the 100-mile ultra trail Mont Blanc, and now the 2011 Tour des Géants. The Tour des Géants study was, as it happens, coordinated by Guillaume's brother Grégoire, a sports physiologist at the University of Lausanne, who went on to surpass Guillaume's accomplishment by finishing second in the race in 2012. The basic measure of fatigue Guillaumier uses in his studies is simple. How much does the biggest force you can produce with a given muscle decline? Not surprisingly, he has found that the force produced by two key muscle groups in the legs, the quadriceps and the calves, gets progressively weaker as the distance of a running race increases. Up to a point. By the time you've been out there for about 24 hours, your leg muscles will be 35 to 40% weaker, and they won't lose much more. In fact, his Tour de Géant subjects, who took more than 100 hours on average to complete the race, ended up losing just 25% of their pre-race leg strength. A result that, on the surface, makes little sense. Okay, Mie jokes. So if I run 200 miles, I'm less fatigued than if I run 100 miles. This counterintuitive finding on its own already hints that leg muscles aren't what ultimately limit ultra-endurance athletes. And there are some more subtle details. The electrically stimulated twitch data allows Mie to estimate how much of the force loss is due to fatigue in the muscles themselves and how much is central, reflecting either diminished output from the brain or losses in transmission via the spinal cord. For ultra-endurance runs, it turns out, the muscles themselves typically only lose about 10% of their force-producing capacity. The rest is central, reflecting a progressive decline in the brain's voluntary activation of muscle. The brain is able to do more, but it doesn't, Mie says. But he adds, that doesn't necessarily mean the brain is responsible for this decline. When Mie compared muscle fatigue following 3 hours of running to similar durations of cycling and cross-country skiing, he found that voluntary activation declined by 8% in running, but didn't change in cycling or skiing. The difference between these three activities? The impact forces in running cause microscopic damage that alters the properties of your leg muscles, unlike the two impact-free activities. Even though voluntary activation is, by definition, a reduction in the command signal from your brain, it appears to respond to what's happening in your muscles. We have special nerve fibers that send information from the muscles to the brain about pressure, heat, damage, metabolic disturbances, and any number of other data points. And we integrate this information in our actions without even realizing it. Trying to make a clean divide between brain fatigue and muscle fatigue, in other words, is inevitably an oversimplification because they're inseparably linked. Perhaps more important, the link between leg fatigue, whether central or peripheral, and actual race performance is far from straightforward. Okay, so I'm losing 40% of my maximal force, Mine says. Is that the explanation for why my speed is reduced? No, at least not directly. If you're competing in a 100-mile race, the pace you'll be running at the 95-mile mark will require far less than 60% of your maximal muscle output. If a bear jumps out from behind a tree, you will discover you can still sprint, which means that whatever was dictating your pace, it wasn't the inability of your muscles to deliver more force. That's the same observation that Samuel Marcora made in his 2010 Mind Over Muscle study. His subjects cycled at 242 watts until they could no longer continue, but were somehow able to generate 731 watts in a 5-second sprint. At the point of exhaustion in a long endurance challenge, the legs are merely unwilling, not incapable. So, if it's not muscle fatigue, what is it? Both Marcora and Millet argue that a variety of factors feed into the brain's decision to speed up, slow down, or stop. In ultra races like the Tour de Géant, relatively unsexy talents like the ability to scarf down prodigious amounts of calorie-rich food and keep running without throwing up are absolutely crucial. If you can't do that, an empty fuel tank will be your limiting factor. In hilly mountain races, the microscopic muscle damage inflicted with each stride is magnified by the jarring eccentric muscle contractions as you race downhill, a drama that plays out in miniature in the early downhill miles of the Boston Marathon every April. If your legs aren't hardened against the rigors of downhill running, your muscles really will limit your speed, but as a result of structural damage and the associated pain and loss of coordination, rather than ordinary fatigue. For Stéphane Coulot, these and many other factors were coming together perfectly during the second half of the race. No blisters, no stomach problems, and his legs continued to carry him up and down the mountain trails without complaint. By the time he stopped for 3 minutes to down a beer and some solid food at the Alpine Hut below the 9,000-foot Champion Col, he had moved up to fourth place and was more than 12 hours ahead of his pace from the previous year. The trouble, when it came, seemed minor at first. He felt too hot. In the village of Bosses, he stripped off his T-shirt, shorts, and shoes, and jumped into a fountain to cool off for 5 minutes. Back on the trail, he pressed on as night fell. A text message arrived telling him that one of the runners ahead of him was disqualified, moving him up to third. The news buoyed him, but also filled him with a sense of urgency, and he hurried on despite flashes of dizziness and overheating. By that point, he recalls, I knew I was failing. During the descent to the penultimate hut, just 7 miles from the finish, a section of the trail he knew by heart, he lost his way 5 times. And when he arrived, he made a catastrophically bad decision. Waving off the meal, hot drink, and bed offered by the hut keeper, and plunging back into the night after downing a glass of water without even refilling his bottles. I was unable to think and reason, he says. My brain did not work correctly. 15 minutes later, he collapsed. He had been running for 85 hours and 30 minutes, stopping to rest for a total of just 3 hours and 20 minutes. Millet, in his own race a year earlier, had done something similar, less than 3 hours of sleep during an 87-hour effort, and was hallucinating by the end, unable to distinguish between waking and dreaming. Coulot wasn't so lucky, though the weather, mild by mountain standards, was fortunate indeed. Although his legs would no longer carry him, he managed to wrap himself in his feather-light emergency blanket without tearing it and turn his headlamp to flashing mode, then dialed Millet on his cell phone. It was after midnight, so Millet had already turned his phone off. When I got the message the following morning, I thought he was dead, Millet recalls. The message was hardly audible, like someone dying. 90 minutes later, another runner arrived and wrapped Coulot in his Gore-Tex vest and another emergency blanket. Eventually, Coulot woke to a violent shaking from a doctor accompanied by a mountain guide. They took him down to their 4x4, a half-hour hike away, and then back to civilization. We are rarely running to death, Millet says. Factors like excessive heat, drugs, and prolonged sleep deprivation, the likely culprit in Coulot's ordeal, can alter the body's delicate balance, but our brain protects us against our own excess, almost always. Most of life, of course, plays out somewhere between the extremes, neither lifting a car nor running through the mountains for 80 hours straight. So, where is the crossover between short, muscle-limited acts of strength and prolonged tests of will? To explore this question, Norwegian researcher Christian Freud, working under the joint supervision of Guillaume Millet and Tim Noakes, put volunteers through a series of time trials, lasting 3, 10, and 40 minutes. The time trials were a little unusual. Instead of the typical exercise bike or treadmill, the subjects had to forcefully kick their legs once every 2 seconds while strapped into a force measuring device called a dynamometer. The advantage of this setup was that the apparatus permitted tests of maximum voluntary force with or without an additional electric shock as frequently as every minute. Since muscles begin recovering from fatigue within a few seconds, this is the only way to get reliable fatigue measurements that aren't skewed by the time it takes to get off a bike and into a dynamometer. The results, which were published in 2016, echoed some of the patterns in Millet's ultra-endurance data. Muscle fatigue dominated in the shortest trials, while central fatigue was increasingly important in the longer ones. In fact, the maximal force measurements taken during the longer trials showed that fatigue in the muscles themselves soon reached a fairly stable plateau at about 80% of full strength, which persisted until the subjects launched into their finishing kick at the end of the trial. That suggests that the importance of purely muscle-based fatigue in long events has been, if anything, overestimated by previous studies. If your leg muscles are really shot at the end of a one-hour race, it's largely because you high-stepped down the final straightaway. The most interesting detail in Freud's study is the pacing. In the 10 and 40-minute trials, just as in the mile, 5,000, and 10,000-meter running world records, the subjects sped up to finish with a flourish. In the 3-minute trial, on the other hand, they struggled to simply avoid slowing down too much, which, not coincidentally, is the near ironclad rule in 800-meter racing. When David Rudasha, a long, lean 23-year-old from the Maasai tribe in Kenya, set the current 800-meter record of 1 minute 40 seconds 91 milliseconds at the 2012 London Olympics, he ran his first lap in 49.28 seconds and his second lap in 51.63 seconds, a slowdown of 2.35 seconds. That's typical of elite 800-meter races, according to Ross Tucker's analysis of world record pacing. In all records going back to the first modern record in 1912, the second lap has been, on average, 2.4 seconds slower than the first lap. Only twice in that time has an 800-meter record been set with a faster second lap, which is the opposite of what is seen in longer races. In fact, the 3-second improvement in the record since the 1960s is almost entirely due to runners speeding through a faster first lap. The second lap has stayed nearly constant, suggesting some sort of physiological limit for sprinting on fatigued legs. Such patterns are highly unlikely to occur purely by chance, and Freud's data offer some clues about what is going on. He put electrodes on his subjects' quadricep muscles to measure the electrical impulses passing from the brain to the muscle as a way of approximating how strongly the brain was demanding contractions. In the 10 and 40-minute trials, these EMG signals mirrored the actual force produced by the muscles, with a sharp increase in both EMG and force near the end of the trials. But in the 3-minute trials, the patterns were different. While the force was gradually decreasing, the EMG signal was still increasing. In a 3-minute trial, and presumably in 800-meter races, the brain still calls for a sprint as the finish line approaches. The muscles are simply unable to obey. If you're looking for the midpoint between the muscles' role in hoisting a car and the brain's role in running an ultra, this is as good a definition as any. That agonizing point, about 600 meters into an 800-meter race, where you're holding nothing back but can feel yourself slowing anyway. Runners have a phrase for that feeling. It doesn't show up in dictionaries. To rig, as in, I thought I was going to win the race, but I started rigging on the final turn. It's derived from rigor mortis, the stiffening of the body after death, and it's one of those words that perfectly capture an otherwise baffling sensation. Sometimes, when you're watching a middle-distance race, you can see the exact moment when someone starts tying up, another euphemism in common use, as their stride shortens and their movements get jerky. And if you've been in that situation yourself, you can't help wincing in sympathy. So why is it that your muscles fail you when you rig? The traditional explanation has long been that they are overwhelmed by a flood of lactic acid, which is produced when you're working so hard that oxygen-fueled aerobic energy supplies can't keep up with demand. After all, rigging typically occurs in events lasting between about 1 and 10 minutes, which corresponds to the duration in which the highest levels of lactate are produced in your blood. And the severity of the rig can be diminished ever so slightly by ingesting baking soda, which counters rising acidity in much the same way that it reacts with acetic acid, that is, vinegar, in grade school volcano models. The downside of baking soda doping, while we're on the volcano theme, is the potential for explosive diarrhea. While this perception of the lactic burn is still widespread, lactate has undergone a rehabilitation in scientific circles, thanks primarily to George Brooks, a researcher at the University of California, Berkeley. Brooks and others have shown that lactate plays a complex role in muscles, serving as a crucial source of emergency fuel during intense exercise. Top athletes, far from being immune to lactate, are actually able to recycle it into fuel more efficiently than lesser athletes. Moreover, if lactate was really the problem, you'd be able to reproduce the sensation of rigging by injecting lactate into your muscles. But as it turns out, it's not that simple. In a 2014 study, Marcus Ammon and Alan Light, along with colleagues at the University of Utah, tried injecting three different metabolites associated with intense exercise, lactate, protons, and adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, into the thumb muscles of 10 lucky volunteers. The concentrations they used varied from the normal concentrations that are always circulating in the body to the higher levels associated with moderate, vigorous, and extreme exercise. On their own, none of the three metabolites had any discernible effect. The same was true when they were injected in pairs, despite the fact that lactate plus protons is what makes lactic acid. But when they injected all three metabolites together, the volunteers suddenly had the bizarre sensation of extreme fatigue and discomfort concentrated in their thumbs. At low doses, the sensations reported by the volunteers were mostly things like tired and pressure. As the doses increased, the sensations racked up in intensity and shifted to pain-related words like ache and hot. The results suggest that lactic burn isn't literally the feeling of acid dissolving your muscles. Instead, it's a cautionary signal created in the brain by nerve endings that are triggered only in the presence of three key metabolites. As we saw in the previous chapter, Ammon has used fentanyl to block these nerve signals so that his subjects are incapable of feeling this lactate proton ATP burn. The result, in cycling time trials, is that the subjects start fast and initially feel great, but eventually run into trouble as their muscles stop responding properly. Ammon's theory is that the lactate proton ATP feedback is the brain's way of ensuring that the muscles themselves never exceed a critical level of stress and disruption. If you disable this protective system, for example, with fentanyl, then you become capable of pushing your muscles closer to their real limits. At that point, elevated levels of other metabolites, such as phosphate, begin to interfere directly with the ability of muscle fibers to contract. Is it possible to reach